Welcome to Leaders and Legends with Steve Rao on Jazz by 99.9 FM, high definition, and 1490 AM. And we want to wish, first of all, everyone a very happy Indian Independence Day. And we have 1947 was the day India received independence from Britain and became the world's largest democracy. We have many immigrants from India in the Triangle, many immigrants from all over the world. And we thought it would be very appropriate on this weekend to have a immigration discussion with Jeremy Robbins, who's a friend of mine. He's the CEO of New American Economy. I'm a member of the New American Economy. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
Yes. And so, Jeremy, just as a refresher today, if you could just, for the listening, those who are just tuning in, just a little bit of a recap of the New American Economy, who you are, your mission, your purpose, that would be wonderful.
Thanks. Yeah, happy to. So New American Economy is a coalition of more than 500 CEOs and mayors that Michael Bloomberg started just over 8 years ago to make the economic case for immigration reform. The central theory was that the one thing everyone in this country seems to agree on is that our immigration system is broken, yet continually we make no progress towards fixing it. And one of the principal reasons we can't fix it is that we're having two very different immigration conversations in the country, that both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, use immigration as an issue to gin up their base to win elections. They have a conversation about families and human rights on the left and a conversation about law and order and national security on the right. And both of those are immigration conversations. But what ends up happening is that when they get into Congress, the two sides just start speaking right past each other and they have a food fight. And the theory of New American Economy is that if you can start a conversation about how immigration actually impacts the economy, how immigration actually impacts communities around the country, you can actually have a productive conversation. One, you'd get better immigration policy, but two, hopefully we can finally fix the immigration system by getting both sides in a way that they can talk together.
That's right. Yes, Jeremy. And I tell you, for those listening, the economic data is staggering. You can go to newamericaneconomy.org. And when I talk, I'm out there on the road for us in North Carolina, the economics is quite amazing. I mean, most of the Fortune 500 were started by immigrants. You know, the brands from, you know, Google to Yahoo to Nordstrom's, Best Buy, I mean, Colgate. I mean, we don't realize some of these companies were founded by immigrants. So, you know, tell me a little bit about what you're hearing about, you know, states like North Carolina. We have a highly skilled immigration population here, lots of green card holders, very frustrated and concerned right now the green card backlog. I want to thank GC Reforms for the work they're doing. What do we do here, Jeremy? I mean, there are people concerned.
Yeah.
You know, can you talk a little bit about skill-based immigration, the economic impact, and what do I tell these Indian American and South Asians that have been having green cards for 12 years?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So let me start really broadly and talk about quickly how immigrants impact North Carolina, and then we could talk about the specific challenges that are getting faced in North Carolina. And North Carolina as a state is really a microcosm for the country. You see immigration at the very high skilled end in the Research Triangle. You see immigration through the agricultural industry in a really profound way. You see it through almost every single major industry that North Carolina has, whether it's construction, whether it's hospitality, whether it's software development. And what ends up having the impact that immigration has, so there are right now almost 800,000 immigrants in North Carolina. The collective impact they have on the economy in terms of their spending power and taxes are enormous. Immigrants in North Carolina have more than $17 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars in spending power each year. They pay just shy of $6 billion in state, local, and federal taxes. And they're starting new companies, they're bringing new ideas. Just looking at entrepreneurs alone, there are almost 48,000 companies owned by an immigrant in North Carolina, and that means that's 120,000 jobs for North Carolina residents, that's immigrants and native-born alike, who are just working at immigrant-owned companies. And so we can talk, I'm happy to go more in depth and talk more about the different ways it impacts each industry, but you see right now what's happening in Washington is that there's been a real backlash against immigration, and that's happened in a lot of different ways. It's happened administratively, through efforts to make it harder or impossible to work here if you're the spouse of a high-skilled worker. You've seen it through efforts to try and take the students. We're training some of the brightest minds in the world at North Carolina universities that are coming from all the world to study in science, technology, engineering, and math here. And there's efforts to repeal ways for them to stay, so we're going to send them right home. There's been a strong effort to repeal a rule to allow people to come here and start a company, create jobs. For dreamers, the kids who came here before the age of 16, who have completed high school or are studying or are working and stayed right with the law, it's called the dreamer population, there have been a huge number of efforts to unwind what's called the DACA program to protect them. And so those have very real impacts on the North Carolina economy, but also on communities all throughout the state.
Yeah, and I mean, there's 35,000 or 38,000 dreamers in North Carolina, and the NAE cites that they bring over $62 million of taxes. We've got probably 60,000 Asian Americans in the Research Triangle, and many of them are listening to the show this morning. They have green cards. Maybe 25,000 have applied, and I think they only grant maybe 1,000. So what advice do you have? So GSE reform, and we want to thank them if they're listening, they're asking for... There's a few bills on the House and Senate floor that are calling for the reduction of the cap on green card. Could you address why there is such a green card backlog? Why is it when I brought in when I spoke to Congressman Krishnamurthy from Chicago, he said that it takes 150 years, and he's going to be coming on our show in a few weeks. But tell me why is this problem occurring, and what advice can GSE reform pull this off? Can we reduce the cap? Why do we need a cap?
Right. So we have these arbitrary caps that if you think of them, they make very little economic sense and they make very little political sense as well. And so effectively what happened is, and I'm going to go back a little bit for this, we had an immigration system in the 20s, put in place in the 1920s, that was based on racial quotas. So in 1965, the last time our immigration system was reformed, they got rid of racial quotas. And that was a huge step forward. And in place of racial quotas, they put in a system of family reunification, which was, at the time, a huge step forward. What that didn't anticipate was a globalized economy where immigration was going to become such an economic weapon, where when people could move so easily from one country to another, that employment was an afterthought. And so they set up a system where just 14% of all of the green cards went for high-skilled workers. But that includes spouses and dependents. So really only 7% of the permanent green cards went for workers. Now, that number doesn't change from year to year. So if you're in a boom time or a slow time, we have the same number of visas. And so that makes no economic sense. But then to compound that, they set up a system whereby only 7% of those 7% of visas could go to any singular country. And that meant that countries, India in particular, China, that were sending a huge number of employment-based immigrants to our country, effectively would start a bottleneck. And every year, as we sent more and more people who came over on temporary visas, on H-1Bs, and wanted to stay, and would apply for a green card, and would have a path to a green card, would get stuck in this bottleneck because there are only 7% allowed per country. The estimates have ranged up to a recent estimate had that if you apply today for a green card and you're from India, your wait time could be 70 years. And so there have been a lot of efforts to get rid of it. There's a current bill in the House, H.R. 392, which is the Fairness for High School Immigrants Act, which would eliminate the caps. It's a very good bill. It actually got passed as part of the DHS, with the Department of Homeland Security appropriations markup just a couple weeks ago. But that's a long way from there to getting across the finish line. And it faces a huge number of hurdles before getting enacted into law. It's a bill that is immensely popular. There are more than 300 of the 435 members of the House have co-sponsored it. Not even voted for it, co-sponsored it.
Wow.
There's virtually no one who thinks it's a bad idea because of the obstacles right now to getting legislation on the floor and passed. The odds are actually very long that it's going to become law. And so we as an organization and many others are continuing to fight very hard to get there. But it's right now it's a very – Congress is fundamentally broken, and it's a very difficult climate to try and move legislation.
Is there a Senate bill that does the same thing, or is there just a House bill?
So the Senate does not. So right now, it's when that bill was passed as part of the DHS appropriations bill, it wasn't passed as a standalone bill. It wasn't moved through the Judiciary Committee, where someone introduced a bill and they'd mark it up and then it would go to the floor. in effect, what it was done was stuck onto another bill, an appropriations bill. The Senate does not stick on bills like that in the same way that the House does. So it's actually very unlikely that that's why it's such a difficult path for that bill through the appropriations process.
Yeah.
We are continuing to push it through that through the regular judiciary process. And the last time it got a vote, I believe the vote was 389-15 in the House, and then it stalled the Senate. That there's huge and overwhelming support for this. This is sort of a there's no coherent argument about why we would want to discriminate based on where someone's from.
Yeah,
right?
If
someone is here and they are the right worker and they have a path to a green card, making them wait 70 years is unconscionable.
And do you believe that, and I think the GC reform people have mentioned a Senate bill, but I mean, this House Bill 392, that's a really encouraging. Before we get into DACA, and then we're going to talk a little bit about just the path to reform, because there's just so many moving parts in this thing. But why do you believe, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. So President Trump and the administration. Hello, Jeremy, are you there? So, Jeremy, we were talking about the skilled immigrants and the H-1B and you know, basically the progress that's being made across the Congress to eliminate the cap. But why is it, in your opinion, that in the new American economy's opinion, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. So President Trump and many Republicans are saying that the reason we want to eliminate green cards is because they're taking away American jobs. So from an economics perspective, if we take the emotion out of it and we take a macro view, what in your opinion is that, how would you debate that to the White House?
Yeah, I mean, look, the idea that that folks who argue against immigrants tend to espouse is this idea that the labor market is a zero-sum game, right? That a job either goes to an immigrant or it goes to a native-born, and that somehow if you could just cut off all immigration, that all those jobs will go to American workers. And as any economist will tell you, that's not the way the labor market works. You think about just an individual company. That company is growing or it's stagnant or it's shrinking. And if you can get the right worker, that company is going to grow. And that's exactly how the economy works. We want to have a dynamic economy that's growing. That's why you have cities like Raleigh and other North Carolina cities. They're fighting to attract creative, high-skilled workers from all around the country and all around the world to come there because they want to be the place that businesses want to come, that businesses want to expand. They want to have the companies that can out-innovate the rest of the world. And that's how immigrants work. Immigrants have a very different skill set than the native-born. If you look just, for example, in North Carolina, immigrants are way more likely to lack a high school diploma than the native-born. They're way more likely to be at the low-skilled end, but they're also way more likely to have a graduate degree.
And do you believe?
And native-born tend to congregate in the middle.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is that when immigrants come in, you have a more diverse workforce. You have a more flexible workforce. You have different skills. And that's a benefit to the economy at large. It makes your companies more productive, and it makes them grow.
So it actually, I think you've heard statistics. I've heard you say before that, you know, for every technology job that you create, you're going to create two American jobs, right? And there's a ripple effect in terms of economic production. Do you also think that the IT shortage of skills and with all these new industries are emerging, that if people are here on a green card, do you believe that the faster we give them the path to citizenship, the better it is for them producing the jobs of the new economy, the jobs of the future?
I think at the end of the day, having people who are coming here, especially skilled immigrants who are coming here, who are helping us out in the world, helping our companies be more flexible, is going to help us grow. And I think when you look at the data, you see that very clearly. Studies about that look at H-1Bs and their impact on job growth. I've seen estimates that range from about every H-1B creates about 1.5 to as many as 7 different jobs, depending on the studies that have looked at this. I think that probably the best studies seem to look at closer around every H-1B creates about 2 jobs. And there are a lot of reasons for that, right? Because these are innovation type jobs that you're creating new products, new product lines. They're also jobs that have support systems all around them. And they're also jobs without which a lot of product lines and other things just couldn't function. And so you think about if you can get the right technology person on a team, then you can fill out the rest of the team. And in that way, having technology workers, having innovation workers, is a very beneficial thing to the American workers who work with them.
Yeah, I have the debate all the time. I'm also in the tech sector, but I think there is just a lack of skilled ability, you know, and the technologies are emerging so fast that, you know, we
right.
can't keep up with, you know, AI and all these different things. But, and before we get into DACA, so, what do you believe, like entrepreneurship visas, and, you know, does the NAE, you know, obviously you believe in accelerating the path to citizenship, who are those are here legally, is something we do, but do you believe that if we don't do that, there's a fear, there's a danger of brain drain, that, you know, people would say, well, okay, if they're making it so hard in America, then I'm going to go to Canada, I'm going to go to Europe. Is that true? Is that a rumor? Or do you see that over these years, you've been doing this for a while now, is that a viable threat?
We live in a globalized world, right? I mean, and people have a lot of options. I think one of the benefits of the United States is that we have the strongest economy in the world. We are still, when people vote with their feet, we're the place they want to come. But we're not the only place in the world. And you see Silicon Valley, Canada recently took out a billboard in Silicon Valley, and the billboard said, having trouble getting your H-1B visa, come to Canada, you'll have residency within months. They're not saying that Canada is the most attractive country to come to. They're not saying it's that the jobs are better. They're not saying it's more beautiful. They're literally just saying, we know you want to go to the U.S., but Canada is going to let you in the U.S. isn't. And I think similarly, when you do things like you tell high school workers, hey, we're not going to let your spouse work, or we're going to have this crazy process where to get your visa, you have to go by lottery, and only a third of you are going to win each year. And then once you get it, you're going to have to wait as many as 70 years to get actually permanent residency. Yeah, of course, you're going to get people who are going to start turning away. And you're seeing that already with companies that are starting to make decisions, whether they're moving some operations to India, or they're moving some operations to British Columbia. More and more, you're seeing people getting frustrated because the workers that they want can't get here. And workers are going to make decisions. There are a lot of good places in the world right now to work.
One final question before we get into DACA and the path to reform. The spouses of the H-1B, does NAE support retaining? Right now, that's a big controversy in the Triangle, and even in Charlotte, is that the spouses of these H-1Bs, and I think the Trump administration was proposing that they eliminate that. Are we going to be able to keep that? Hopefully we will with some of this legislation.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
The spouses of H-1Bs. I think it's called EAD-4, that right now they're not, I think...
Oh, the spouses.
Yeah,
the H-1B spouses, right. So what the Trump administration is trying to do is rescind a rule that President Obama's administration put in that would allow a large number of the spouses of H-1B high-skilled workers, people who are almost called an H-4 visa, work. And so there's an effort now to repeal that, and they haven't given the formal notice, but that is expected to come relatively soon. We as an organization are working really hard to oppose that and just to keep the ability of high-skilled spouses to work. We've done, if you look at all the research, it shows that one, smart people tend to marry smart people, and if you can keep more people working in the economy, that's good for the economy. But as you said, it's also a huge role in our ability to attract talent. People are going to want to come if their husband or their wife can't work. And so I think it's a very important thing for people who are listening who are in that situation to tell their story, especially when the comment period opens. There's going to be a period where they are going when they give notice for the rule, there's ability to submit a public comment. The administration has to respond to all of those comments. And so to the extent that one of their justifications is going to be that this is harming the American economy, there's the imperative to show that it's not, to show the situations where a spouse is working and working in a field that is having real impact. And certainly if it's a field where there aren't others with those qualifications in the area, I think that's going to be a big challenge and one we're going to be working really hard on.
Well, we appreciate that. So in the few minutes we have remaining, let's talk about DACA and Dreamers and then maybe a little bit about the refugees. And we could spend hours on this interview, but you're doing a great job, by the way. So a lot of confusion out there. We want to protect the Dreamers. NAE stands by that. Can you talk a little bit about the court orders and the fear of there being a stay and the Dreamers' status being expired, and then they would have to be going back? So what's going on?
Yeah.
And what's your quick update?
Yeah, so the update on DACA, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which President Obama started to not give citizenship, but to give a what's called a deferral from deportation and work authorization to say to these kids who came when they were 16 or before, when they're younger than 16 or younger, who are playing right by the rules, who are graduating college, who are working, to say, we're not going to deport you and we're going to let you stay and work on a 2-year basis. The president, Trump, has tried to unwind that program in several different phases. He first gave 6 months for Congress to act. Congress did not act. He then there have been efforts to cut, and the battle right now is being fought in the courts. And so there have been multiple court decisions that are conflicting, that have stayed the decision, that have basically stopped him from unwinding it, that have tried to force him to keep accepting applications. And so right now, the administration is still accepting applications and renewals. And so certainly I encourage people who are in that situation to renew, because there's a case ongoing in Texas right now, and it's unclear how it's going to resolve with the judge that originally gave the first order.
Okay, so
halting DACA.
It's still in a process. And then, you know, Kenny Murillo, we had him on the show a few months ago, and, you know, he was a dreamer that worked 3 jobs to go to community college at Wake Tech. Then he worked his way to go to Furman, and he wants to go to medical school. And, I mean, it's just like, you know, I think these are kids that are bringing value, economic opportunity. And so thank you for keeping us in the loop on that. Where do you stand on, or do you believe right now that the children are being reunited? Do you believe that that was just wrong to separate parents, or do you just think we're working through the process now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, like fundamentally what we believe is that this is an issue Congress needs to address, and whether or not the president has authority to do this. I mean, I think there's a very, very strong argument that the president has the authority, the legal authority to have the DACA program. And when President Obama first did it, more than 100 of the leading law firms in the country signed an open letter talking about why this was a legal move. But putting that aside, none of that changes the fact that Congress has the authority to help these kids. More than 90% of Americans, or close to 90% of Americans, think that we shouldn't be deporting Dreamers. And of course they don't, because these are kids who came here with their parents, who have done everything right. They are American in all sense of the words, except for the legal one. And they, for many of them, they don't really know the country. They don't really have no memory or no experience or no family in the country that they came from. And so sending them back is both cruel and economically harmful. But not saying America should be in the business of. So I think right now the imperative is on Congress. This is not a hard issue, but they're making it one, right?
Right.
This is one where the vast majority of the public wants to protect these kids. They want to let them stay here legally. They want to give them a path to become citizens, to become Americans, provided that they are working, that they're not violating the law, they're not committing crimes. And so I think there are a number of bills, bipartisan bills in both houses that would pass with ease if they're put on the floor. And so for us, this is really as simple as leadership in both houses saying, look, again, like the Fairness for High School Immigration Act about the green card caps, like these are bills that will pass without any controversy if they're put on the floor. And so we are continuing to pressure leadership to do so.
Okay, just a final couple of questions. Refugees. There's, I think every September, the presidential administration will put a ceiling. So I think they've gone from maybe around 25,000-30,000. What are your thoughts on that? And does NAE support bringing refugees in to America, sanctuary cities, these
right.
kinds of things?
So there are all sorts of reasons why cutting refugees is a bad idea. There's certainly the moral argument that people talk about if we are going to fight ISIS and fight all these horrible things, closing your doors so that people fleeing these groups is an irresponsible policy. But there's also a real economic one, that there are few people who love America more than people who really know some of the worst things in the world and see what we have. And refugees, for that reason, they're coming here and have historically embraced America in a very profound way. If you look at their earnings when they get here, refugees make almost nothing when they get to America. They make, on average, about $7,000 a year in their first 5 years. Their levels of English are low, and they need a lot of help at first to get off the ground. However, refugees very, very quickly increase their earning. They increase their English. They increase their educational attainment. And by the time they've been here close to 25 years, the average refugee is making $68,000 a year, which is way more than the average American. And so the idea that we are going to cut off this avenue of people who are coming, who are embracing our country, who are being successful is one that is nonsensical in a lot of ways. The strongest argument made against refugees is a security threat. is the idea that refugees are going to bring terrorism or crime. But the data just doesn't belie it. If you look at the top 10 cities that have accepted the most refugees per capita over the last 10 years, 9 of the 10 of them have had their crime rates fall, and almost all, and a bunch of them had their crime rates fall precipitously. The one that didn't, the only outlier, is Springfield in Western Massachusetts, which was one of the centers of the opioid epidemic. And so the idea that refugees are bringing crime is one that simply isn't borne out by any of the data.
That's really helpful. So one last question, then I'll get the closing question of the interview, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask it. So we have a lot of mayors, city council members, that, and myself included, that listen to this show. And what can cities do today? I've been keeping up with some of the great things that Dallas is doing, the Asheville Chamber of Commerce, sort of opening the door for dreamers. So could you just in 10 seconds tell us, how can cities learn about the things that they can do, given the fact that North Carolina, our hands are tied by the legislature, which are not allowing sanctuary cities? So what can be done?
That's a great question. And it's very easy to say, oh, well, immigration is a federal issue. We can't issue a visa, therefore we can do nothing. But if you look at what cities are doing around the country, cities are taking an enormous lead in the immigration movement in really profound and practical ways. If you look at Amazon was looking where it was going to relocate its headquarters. The entire country was talking about Amazon HQ2 and the 20 cities that it chose. Well, it chose those cities for a lot of reasons, but one thing that's common to all those cities is those cities are cool cities. They're cities the creative class wants to go to. They're cities that Amazon could imagine its employees wanted to go to. And one part of that is that those are diverse places, and that almost every single one of those cities are cities that have leaned in and said, you know what, we're going to lead on immigration. We are going to become a welcoming place. We are going to draft a welcoming plan. We are going to be the kind of place where immigrants are going to come. We're going to have the services ready for them to succeed. We're going to make them part of our economic strategy. And so what can cities do? Cities can have an office of new Americans to make sure that every action that they take helps leverage the power of immigrants and makes immigrants brought into all their services. They can have immigrant entrepreneur programs to attract and support immigrant entrepreneurs. They can have language access programs to ensure that people in their community speak different languages, they can still access all city services. They can have community policing where they're working with police and immigrant communities to make sure that there's cooperation. You have more people reporting crimes and being part of the community, and make them places where immigrants are better integrated and where we're better leveraging their potential. And that's something that a new American economy, we spend a lot of time helping places do. And so we encourage anyone who's working in a city who's interested in that to contact us. And we have projects going all around the country, as you mentioned, with Dallas and others, really trying to help cities lead and be at the forefront of this fight.
Well, we'll take you up on that. And we're going to be bringing Jeremy in a couple of months here to the region as we do continue this roadshow around the state of North Carolina on immigration reform. And you can go to newamericaneconomy.org for any of the statistics and even to learn about these city programs. My final question before we close out and a few announcements is, we participated in an NAE call with Senator Tillis a few months ago. He was, you know, talking about the different moving parts and, you know, basically the immigration reform being a way of bridging the skill base with border security technology and DACA. So how does NAE today, where do you stand? What are the things that you're trying to achieve? And how would you suggest that the United States Congress, the United States Senate work with this president? Maybe it'll be after these elections, 2018, but hopefully before, to do all the things that we discussed: skill, dreamers, refugees, the whole enchilada. You know, how do we pull off reform?
Yeah, what's the fix? Yeah, it's a great question. I think what's very clear is that our immigration system isn't working and that we need a modern immigration system, an immigration system that works for Americans and for immigrants alike, that thinks about how do we grow, how do we leverage immigration that's better helping our communities, and how do we protect against any dangers? And so for that, I think we need a system that looks at, all right, how do we attract the smartest people in the world? How do we fill gaps in our economy, especially in labor-intensive industries? How do we take people who have been here for years, who have been productive members of society or important members of their community, and give them a path to legal status if they don't have one? And how do we ensure that employers are playing by the rules and that we actually have security at the border in ways that aren't just gimmicks, but are real, practical, and smart, and reflect our values? And so for us, I think there's really basic things that you can do. You could have, you could increase the number of high-skilled visas. You could have a visa for entrepreneurs who want to start a company. You should absolutely have a path to citizenship for dreamers and a path to legal status for undocumented immigrants who are here. For place things like temporary protected status that's being unwound and for people who would have to go back to countries that they haven't lived in for maybe 20 or 30 years that still are not safe. We shouldn't be kicking the people out. We should be finding a way for them to stay here productively. And for American workers, we should be smart about ways to ensure that we're protecting American workers. And that's all doable.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate it. First of all, it's been such an honor for me to work with you and the team. It's been one of the most fun things I've ever done, in addition to having a radio show and being a commentator on radio and serving in public office. But we want to thank you, Chris Steinman, just the team, everybody that's been working with us in North Carolina. We're going to continue the fight and continue to bring the economic impact of immigration. So you can go to newamericaneconomy.org. Just happy Independence Day event at 10 a.m. tomorrow at the Hindu Temple of North Carolina, right there on Aviation Parkway. Governor is going to be there. And then the Triangle Children's Business Fair kicks off. I'll be there to present the awards. And we want to thank Ravi Chakuri and the team at Jazzba FM. And Jeremy, thank you for all that you do on behalf of our country. We thank all of you at the New American Economy for fighting hard to make sure that we can all come together and provide a common sense reform to immigration, but base it on economics. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. It's a privilege to have you as a member leading this effort.
Thank you so
have
much.
A great day.
Yeah, bye.